DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points. Perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Our mission, as always, is to take really complex, dense information and distill it into knowledge that actually sticks with you.
And today, we are taking a journey through the history, the finances, and the culture of an institution that is, you could argue, the blueprint for elite American education.
We are talking about Phillips Academy, but of course, everyone knows it as Andover.
Right, and it's so easy to think of these places as, you know, modern creations of wealth. But Andover's history is, it's truly foundational. When you look at the source material, the dates just jump right out.
They really do. It was founded in 1778.
It's the oldest incorporated academy in the entire United States. They started educating students during the most volatile and uncertain phase of the American Revolution.
And that deep, deep history is matched by its output, which is just astonishing. We're talking about a school whose alumni list includes two U.S. presidents.
George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush.
And five Nobel laureates. That number of Nobel winners, you know, it ties it with only three other high schoolers in the entire world.
That track record alone tells you this isn't just a prep school. It's a centuries-old engine of influence.
So our source material for this deep dive is a genuinely comprehensive stack. It covers everything from, you know, the original intent of its founders to its staggering financial mechanisms today.
And its academic philosophy and some of the more recent cultural reckonings it's had to face. It's all in there.
So let's frame our central question for this deep dive. We really have to understand how a school established in the late 18th century with this very narrow, very specific goal.
To prepare young Calvinist students for the ministry. That was it.
Exactly. How does that school possibly evolve into what it is today? One of the world's highest ranked non-sectarian, and this is crucial, need-blind college preparatory schools, backed by an enormous $1.41 billion endowment.
That transformation is the whole story. It requires a deep dive into centuries of decisions.
And the school's own identity really acknowledges that link between the past and the present through its mottos, right?
Absolutely. The main mottos are in Latin. The first and maybe the most famous one is non sibi.
Which means not for self. It's this ideal of selfless service, which is particularly potent for an elite institution that's designed to train leaders.
Decisely. And the second one, which is just a perfect anchor for analyzing almost 250 years of history, is finis origine pendit.
The end depends upon the beginning.
Exactly. So we are going to spend this entire dive tracing that lineage of Andover and really examining how well it has managed to uphold that selfless ideal of non sibi while navigating these massive shifts in, well, in theology and wealth and in educational philosophy.
All right. Let's unpack that beginning then. So let's start at the beginning. We're talking 1778.
Right in the middle of the revolution. And the founder, Samuel Phillips Jr., he wasn't just some educator. He was a local businessman from a really influential New England family.
And his vision for the school, it wasn't broad at all, was it? It was laser focused.
Yeah, incredibly focused. The whole point was to create a school to educate Calvinist students, specifically for the ministry. That was the mission. An explicitly theological one.
And you can't overstate the context of the founding, the American Revolution itself.
Okay.
Our sources really highlight that New England's traditional educational system was, well, it was in complete disarray.
Oh, totally. The war had created this huge educational vacuum. I mean, think about it. The Boston Latin School, which was the big name, actually had to shut down.
Why was that?
Its headmaster was a loyalist. So when the British evacuated Boston in 1776, he fled north to Canada, just packed up and left.
So Phillips Academy was founded in part to step into that void.
Exactly. It wasn't just filling a need. It was establishing a new patriot-aligned educational stronghold.
And the founders themselves, Samuel Phillips Jr. and the first head of school, Eliphalet Pearson, they were actively involved in the war effort.
I mean, actively involved. They were literally manufacturing gunpowder for the Continental Army right there in town.
So these were not just academics sitting in an ivory tower. They were revolutionaries with a plan for the future leadership of the country.
And they saw the revolution not just as a military conflict, but as, well, an opportunity to get resources for their new school.
What do you mean by that?
The source material notes that they actually tried to stock Andover's first library with books that had been confiscated from the homes of wealthy loyalist families who had fled the area.
Wow, so they're building their library with the spoils of war, essentially.
It speaks volumes, doesn't it? It shows just how immediate and strong the political ties were between the academy and the new American establishment.
And that patriot connection, it gets even more deeply cemented when you look at who they hosted.
Right. George Washington himself, while he was president, made a personal stop at the academy in 1789.
That is a massive early sign of institutional approval from the highest office in the land.
And Washington's visit wasn't just a one-off photo op. The connection was sustained. Eight of Washington's own relatives, nephews, and grandnephews attended Andover in the years right after his presidency.
So from its very first decade, Phillips Academy was directly linked to the political and social elite who were going to guide the new republic.
And when it came time to define the school's visual identity, its seal, they went back to another key revolutionary figure.
Paul Revere. Such a great detail. He didn't just ride, he was a designer.
He designed a very complex, very symbolic seal. It had all these key visual motifs. There was a beehive.
Symbolizing industry, community, everyone working together.
Exactly. There were crops for plenty and prosperity, the sun for enlightenment and knowledge. And surrounding all of this were those two Latin mottos we started with.
Non sibi, not for self. And finis origin pendet, the end depends upon the beginning.
Powerful mottos. But the Academy's original constitution also had two other really important aspirational phrases that speak to their goals.
Which were?
Youth from every quarter and knowledge and goodness.
So youth from every quarter, that sounds like an early commitment to diversity, right? Geographic diversity, at least.
That was the intention, absolutely. Drawing students from all over, not just the local town. But the other part, knowledge and goodness, reminds us of that underlying Calvinist purpose. The education was strictly for fostering virtue and preparing students, at least initially, for religious or public service.
And that vision of expanding access to education, even though it was just for boys at first, it sort of paved the way for its sister institution.
It did. In 1828, Abbott Academy was established right on a neighboring campus, and it became one of the first secondary schools for girls in all of New England.
It's important to see Abbott Academy as this parallel, equally pioneering effort.
For sure. But, you know, the administrations of Phillips and Abbott were very careful to regulate and limit contact between the male and female students. Despite being right next to each other, they kept a strict social distance that really reflected the morals of the time.
Which, of course, eventually changed, leading to that landmark 1973 merger.
And the start of coeducation at Phillips Academy. But as the academy flourished early on, it was still deeply anchored by this orthodox theology. You could really see that with the Andover Theological Seminary.
Right. It shared the campus with Phillips Academy for almost 100 years.
From 1808 all the way to 1907. And the founding of that seminary is just a fascinating snapshot of early 19th century religious politics.
What happened?
Well, it was founded by Orthodox Calvinists who had become really alienated by the theological drift they saw happening at Harvard University.
A more liberal direction.
Exactly. When Harvard appointed a liberal Unitarian professor of theology, these traditionalists basically picked up and moved to Andover to create a sanctuary for strict doctrine.
So it was a conscious, deliberate rejection of Unitarianism. Mm-hmm. And the Phillips family, I assume, was on board with this.
They provided significant financial backing to the seminary. The two institutions were even governed by overlapping boards for a while. This strong, traditional, and really well-funded Calvinist foundation is what defined Andover's early identity. And crucially, it set the stage for the rivalry that would become its most famous cultural marker.
That theological split is the perfect bridge into the next phase, isn't it?
Mm.
Defining the rivalry and the academy's path to becoming this modern powerhouse. We have to talk about Andover versus Exeter.
This is, truly America's oldest high school rivalry. But the origin is even more specific than most people realize.
It's personal.
It's a family feud.
Yeah.
Samuel Phillips Jr. founded Phillips Academy in 1778. Just 3 years later, in 1781, his uncle, John Phillips, founded Phillips Exeter Academy just down the road in New Hampshire.
So the entire educational dynasty was established by two family members with these parallel but competing visions.
Exactly. And as you mentioned, that early rivalry, it wasn't really about athletics. It was all about theological positioning.
Right. Because Andover was so fiercely committed to Calvinist orthodoxy, to the point of hosting the seminary that literally fled from Harvard, it became the main prep school funneling graduates to Yale.
Which was seen as the more Calvinist-friendly university at the time.
And Exeter.
Well, Exeter, being founded by John Phillips, was considered a little less overtly religious. It was more welcoming to Unitarians. So as a result, Exeter became the dominant feeder school for Harvard.
That's just astonishing, a centuries-old rivalry that's actually rooted in an 18th-century theological schism over Unitarianism versus Calvinism. It makes the modern-day football game feel like a much higher-stakes historical conflict.
Well, the rivalry endures, of course.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying D.C. politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
The football game is one of the nation's oldest, played annually since 1878, though they started playing sports against each other way back in 1861.
But institutionally, the religious heart of that rivalry has completely faded.
Completely. Even though the Phillips Academy Constitution originally required all teachers and trustees to be Protestant, a real commitment to that initial Calvinist mission, our sources confirm that both schools are now entirely non-sectarian.
So we see this transition from a religious mandate to a secular idea of excellence. But Andover actually went through a bit of a slump after the Civil War. It took three visionary headmasters to really revive and transform it.
Cecil Bancroft, Alfred Stearns, and Claude Fewes in the late 19th and early 20th centuries.
Bancroft's tenure was really critical for the academics, right?
It was. He dramatically improved Andover's academic reputation by reforming the curriculum. He made sure the courses met and even exceeded the increasingly tough expectations of major university presidents.
And he looked abroad for inspiration.
He did. He proactively studied the best practices of elite English public schools, you know, places like Eton, and he imported and adapted successful educational models from Europe.
This era also established this really intense focus on college placement and academic rigor. The sources describe a sink or swim policy.
Oh, yeah. Underperforming or undisciplined students were, frankly, expelled. And the placement statistics from that time, they really confirm the results of this pressure.
Let's look at the data from the 1930s.
Okay, so in 1931, 64% of Andover graduates were placed at Yale, Harvard, or Princeton.
64%.
And by 1937, that astonishing concentration of success had jumped to 74%.
Wow, so that's what cemented Andover's identity, not just as a religious academy, but as the premier engine for producing Ivy League students.
But to maintain that status, especially with rising competitors, the physical campus needed to be modernized. The school needed money. And this is where we meet the pivotal figure of Thomas Cochran, class of 1890.
Cochran, a powerful banker, a partner at J.P. Morgan.
And he had this singular, incredibly ambitious vision. He wanted to make Phillips Academy the most beautiful school in America. He didn't have any children, and he decided to dedicate his immense philanthropic resources to Andover.
And the financial scale of his gift is staggering, especially when you think about the time period.
He donated roughly $10 million to the school. That money funded a huge campus expansion, including the library, the dining hall, the world-class art gallery.
And when you adjust that $10 million for inflation,
it's equivalent to about $181 million today.
But here's the most fascinating detail about Cochran's commitment, and this really speaks to that non-Sibby ideal.
It's the definition of it. When he died, his entire estate was probated at only $3 million.
Wait, so he gave the school more than three times the value of his own final net worth?
Yes. This level of disproportionate transformative giving just immediately professionalized the fundraising game for elite high schools. It fundamentally changed Andover's ability to compete on the world stage. It moved it from a regional academy to an architectural and financial giant.
It sets a precedent that philanthropy doesn't just fund buildings, it funds an entire institutional leap forward.
Beyond what the donor could even personally hold on to.
And while the campus was being rebuilt with this huge infusion of cash, the school also took its first tentative and often conflicted steps toward diversity.
Phillips Academy does have a history of some remarkable firsts, even if they were slow to really take hold. It was one of the first New England boarding schools to admit black students, starting as early as the 1850s.
And in the 1870s, it educated students who participated in the Chinese educational mission of 1872.
Including Liang Cheng, who later served as the Chinese ambassador to the U.S.
And yet, this early progress stalled. Which highlights a real contradiction, doesn't it?
It does. The sources reveal that under Bancroft's successors, Black representation actually declined drastically. Between 1911 and 1934, only 4 African Americans attended the academy.
Just 4.
And other institutional biases persisted well into the 1940s, when the administration actively capped Jewish enrollment at roughly 5% of the student body.
So this is a crucial paradox to understand. The school had the ideal of youth from every quarter literally written into its constitution.
But the cultural reality of maintaining an elite, predominantly white Protestant identity in the early 20th century led to explicit limitations on access for non-Protestant and non-white students.
This conflicted era finally started to shift pretty dramatically in the post-war period under head of school John Kemper.
Right. He actively led a process of democratization. He really tried to dismantle some of the structures that reinforced social exclusion.
He was responsible for abolishing the school's secret societies in 1949.
He was. He recognized them as sources of elitism and exclusion, though our sources do note that at least one society still operates today.
And more significantly, he ended mandatory attendance at religious services in the early 1970s.
Which really signified the definitive move away from the founder's core Calvinist mandate.
And that drive toward democratization, it all culminated in 1973 with the merger of Phillips Academy and Avid Academy.
After nearly 150 years of regulated contact, the two institutions became one co-educational powerhouse that really cemented its modern identity.
And this institutional maturation also led to greater coordination within that whole secondary education world.
It did. Andover helped establish the 10 Schools Admission Organization in 1952, which was designed to standardize the application process for the top prep schools. And later, it became a founding member of the 8 Schools Association, formalized in 2006.
Positioning it globally at the absolute apex of pre-collegiate education. Okay, that moves us right into the contemporary reality of Phillips Academy Section 3, where we're going to look at the raw data, extreme selectivity, massive wealth, and the demographic profile of the student body today.
And we have to start with selectivity, but size is a really key factor here. Andover is intensely selective. The acceptance rate usually hovers around 13%, but what's unique is how large it is.
Right, it's not a tiny boutique school.
Not at all. Our sources cite this fascinating statistic from 2016. Phillips Academy was actually larger in student population than the other 3 most selective boarding schools combined.
Wow. So it manages to maintain extreme exclusivity despite its scale.
Exactly. And we saw during the pandemic that the selectivity just intensified even more. The acceptance rate dropped to a mere 9% in 2022.
Suggesting that in times of uncertainty, these elite boarding schools become even more desirable commodities for parents.
For sure. Now, let's talk about the financial profile, because the scale of the wealth is just critical to understanding the school strategy.
Okay, lay it on us.
As of September 2024, the endowment was reported at $1.41
billion. $1.41 billion for a high school.
It's an absolutely monumental figure. It provides a level of financial stability and operational freedom that few colleges, let alone other high schools, can even dream of.
And to make sure that endowment keeps pace with their goals, they recently ran a huge capital campaign.
A very successful one. Between 2017 and 2023, the campaign raised $408.9 million. But what's crucial here, and this ties back to that non-SIBI ideal, is where that money was earmarked.
Right.
Over $103 million was dedicated specifically to increasing the financial aid endowment, and another $121 million was targeted for modernizing key campus facilities.
That financial cushion allows them to pursue this ideal of access. But we have to acknowledge the immediate sticker shock. The cost of admission is enormous.
It is. For the 2024-25 school year, boarding tuition is $73,780. Day students pay $57,190.
And the rate of tuition growth over the years has been relentless.
Let's look at the numbers. In the 2001-02 school year, boarding tuition was $26,900.
Okay.
Just 10 years later, 2011-12, it had jumped to $42,350. And now, just over a decade later, it's at $73,780.
That is almost a threefold increase in costs in just over 2 decades.
Which makes the school's financial aid policy a genuine necessity if they're going to fulfill that youth from every quarter ideal.
Right. So since 2007, Andover has used a need-blind admissions policy.
Meaning a student's ability to pay is completely excluded from the admission decision.
And beyond being need-blind, they guarantee they will meet 100% of the demonstrated financial need for every single student they admit.
And the data supports this commitment. 47% of the current students receive some form of financial aid, and 12% are on a full comprehensive scholarship.
and they actively try to diversify the application pool with programs like ILLE.
Right. The ILLE-A program provides funding for prospective financial aid applicants and their guardians, especially from historically underrepresented backgrounds, to visit the campus during the admissions process. It removes that first financial hurdle of just traveling to Massachusetts for a tour.
So we have a school where nearly half its students get aid, but it also has one of the highest tuitions in the country. It begs the question, how integrated is the student body, really? Let's look at the demographics, starting with race and ethnicity.
The Academy reports that 59% of students identify as people of color, which makes the student body significantly more racially diverse than the state of Massachusetts as a whole.
But our sources provide this fascinating comparison of how those numbers change depending on how the data is collected.
They do. When you look at the 2021-22 NCES data, the federal data, which requires a single racial identification, the numbers were 36.5% white, 33.0% Asian, 10.2% Black, and 10.5% Hispanic.
Corporate megastores are spending millions lobbying D.C. politicians on one-sided policies that send small businesses tumbling. They want to enact harmful credit card mandates that take resources away from your local credit union and community bank, leaving Main Street businesses with less access to credit, making it harder for your family to pay for everyday goods like gas and groceries. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.
Okay, so that's one picture.
But if you compare that to a student newspaper survey from March 2023, which allows students to identify with multiple categories, the picture shifts. In that survey, 50.2% identified as white and 42.9% identified as Asian.
So the student's ability to select multiple identities really complicates that standard federal reporting.
It suggests a highly nuanced and multi-ethnic student population. The survey also showed a slight increase in Black students, up to 13.4%.
And the school has a huge global reach, too.
About 15% of the student body are international students, totaling 184 as of March 2024. And it's interesting to note that 55 of those are actually U.S. citizens who live abroad, showing the school's draw even among expatriate American families.
We also have to consider the continuing power of tradition and legacy in this kind of highly selective environment.
Oh, absolutely. The sources indicate that about one in every eight students, so 12.9%, has a parent who is an alumnus. They have deep family ties to the institution.
And even more, at least one in five students has a sibling who attended Phillips Academy. So that legacy factor reinforces that while access is theoretically wide, tradition maintains a really strong gravitational pull.
Now, let's combine that financial data with the admissions reality. Despite this robust financial aid program aimed at broadening socioeconomic access, the student survey from March 2023 painted a very clear picture of affluence.
What did it find?
Nearly half of the student body, 46.8%, reported coming from family household incomes over $250,000 a year.
Over a quarter million a year, and on the other end.
Conversely, only 11.3% of students reported coming from family incomes under $100,000 per year. So while the school effectively meets the need for those lower income students, the high concentration of wealth at the upper end means the community is still predominantly made up of students from the highest socioeconomic strata.
And that creates a real tension, doesn't it? The policy achieves access for a few, but the culture and the norms are defined by the majority of students who come from extreme privilege.
Absolutely. And finally, the political snapshot of the campus shows just how far the institution has moved from its conservative Calvinist origins. The 2023 student survey indicated a decidedly liberal tilt.
38.8% identified as liberal.
But what's particularly striking in that data is the high percentage of students identifying outside the traditional political mainstream.
Right, we saw 8.0% who identified as communist or socialist, which is a surprisingly high number for a prep school survey.
And that group is nearly equal in size to the percentage who identified as conservative, which was only 8.6%.
So that political distribution suggests a campus environment that not only tolerates but actively encourages critical and highly progressive political dialogue.
And the religious data confirms the secularization. Over 40% of the student body identified as either agnostic or atheist.
Compared to only 22.5% identifying as Christian and 16.9% as Catholic. The theological anchor that defined the school's beginning has clearly been removed, replaced by a much more secular and skeptical student body. We've established the historical foundations and the modern profile. Now we shift gears to Section 4, the academic rigor, and the sheer scale and design of the campus that houses it all. Let's look at the structure of learning.
So Phillips Academy uses a trimester program. The academic year is divided into three distinct terms, each lasting about 10 weeks. And this structure provides enormous flexibility and intellectual breadth.
And the resources they devote to instruction are just incredible. The school employs 232 teaching faculty and offers around 300 different courses.
All while maintaining an enviable 7-to-1 student faculty ratio. That low ratio, combined with the huge curriculum, is what really facilitates the deep personalized engagement you expect at this level.
What's particularly fascinating about Andover's curriculum philosophy is its relationship with the Advanced Placement, or AP, program.
Oh, this is the ultimate irony. Phillips Academy actually co-authored the study that led to the creation of the entire Advanced Placement program back in the 1950s.
So they were instrumental in creating the gold standard for high school curriculum acceleration across the whole country. Yet they've walked away from it in the 21st century. Why would they do that?
The sources indicate that Andover made a very deliberate decision to de-emphasize AP classes. And the rationale is simple. They want to maintain absolute curricular flexibility and intellectual independence.
So they prefer to design their own advanced innovative courses.
Exactly. Courses that often exceed the difficulty of the AP curriculum, but without being constrained by the rigid, standardized curriculum and testing requirements that are dictated by the College Board, it's a huge statement about their confidence in their own academic design.
That decision really underscores their intellectual independence. Another marker of that unique approach is their grading system.
Right. Phillips Academy does not rank students, which is designed to foster collaboration over, you know, cutthroat competition. Mm-hmm. They use a unique 6.0 GPA scale.
Where 6.0 is outstanding, 5.0 is an honors grade, and 2.0 is still a passing grade.
The goal is to move the students' focus away from that hyper-competitive ranking. We know from a 2023 student survey that the average GPA was quite high at 5.41, which demonstrates success across the student body.
And in addition to the regular academic year, the school also runs a popular 5-week summer section.
It does. It dates all the way back to 1942. It serves about 600 students entering grades 8 through 12, extending their educational reach beyond the traditional academic calendar.
Now let's consider the physical environment. The campus is colossal 706 acres, located in Andover, Massachusetts.
And the oldest parts of the campus core are highly protected. They're listed on the National Register of Historic Places as part of the Academy Hill Historic District, which encompasses the historic sites of the former Abbott Academy and the Theological Seminary.
And the scale and the beauty of the campus were intentionally engineered. We mentioned Thomas Cochrane's desire to make it the most beautiful school in America.
And to achieve this, Andover hired Frederick Law Olmsted, the legendary landscape architect behind Central Park, and his firm. Olmsted's advice on campus design started in 1891 and continued for 5 decades.
So they ensured the campus was laid out with this grand, intentional, and aesthetically consistent architecture and landscaping.
And when you walk that campus, you encounter buildings named after some truly significant alumni and historical figures.
At Bullfinch Hall, which houses the English department.
Built in 1819, named after Charles Bullfinch, the noted architect who actually taught the hall's designer. Or Morse Hall, which contains the math department, named after Samuel Morse, class of 1805.
The inventor of the telegraph and Morse code. These buildings really anchor the curriculum to the school's historical achievements.
Fast forwarding to the 21st century, you find the Gelb Science Center, built in 2004. This modern facility, which includes a campus observatory, is named after Richard L. Gelb, class of 41.
The heir to the Clairol Hair Care Company. So that philanthropic lineage established by Cochrane continues to fund these major institutional leaps in areas like science and technology.
The Oliver Wendell Holmes Library, known as the OWHL, is another historic centerpiece. It was built in 1929 in the Georgian Revival style, holds over 80,000 books, and it's named after the poet and physician Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., class of 1825.
But though it's historic, it's far from outdated, right? It houses everything from a silent study room to a modern makerspace.
Blending tradition with cutting-edge technology.
I love that the campus itself is just filled with these historical anecdotes. The connection to Harriet Beecher Stowe, for example. Stowe House, one of the dormitories, was her family's former residence.
It's a wonderful human detail that grounds the history. Stowe's husband taught at the Theological Seminary when they lived there, and she famously used the very first royalty check she received from her groundbreaking novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, to renovate the house.
And it was physically moved to its current location in 1929 and is still a central piece of the residential campus.
Speaking of residential life, the sheer size of the student body on campus requires a really sophisticated organization system,
which they call the cluster system.
And the cluster system is the backbone of student life. The dormitories, which vary widely in size, are grouped into five distinct clusters. Each cluster serves as a sub-community of roughly 220 students and about 40 faculty affiliates who live nearby.
And this system manages orientation, social events, study breaks, and provides crucial faculty supervision and interaction,
ensuring that even on a massive 706-acre campus, students feel a sense of a smaller, more cohesive community.
Moving on to Section 5, we need to discuss the truly unique cultural assets that Phillips Academy has. I mean, this is where the institution really transcends high school status and enters the realm of world-class cultural stewardship.
It operates at the level of a small university. You have to start with the Addison Gallery of American Art. This institution was yet another gift from Thomas Cochrane, and it's open to the public.
And its collection is genuinely world-class. This isn't just a nice school gallery. The permanent collection includes seminal American works, like Winslow Homer's iconic painting, Eight Bells.
Alongside pieces by John Singleton Copley, Jackson Pollock, Frank Stella, Andrew Wyeth. And to demonstrate its significance, the gallery underwent a major $30 million renovation and expansion between 2008 and 2010.
Just imagine having access to American masterpieces as part of your high school experience.
Then you have the Robert S. Peabody Institute of Archaeology, founded in 1901. This institute is completely unique for a secondary school. It is one of the nation's major repositories for Native American archaeological collections.
And unlike the Addison Gallery, this is primarily a research facility. It's accessible to researchers and public school groups mainly by appointment.
And the Peabody Institute is really noteworthy for its proactive stance on ethical stewardship. It has been a leader in compliance with the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, since the early 1990s.
That commitment to repatriation and respect for historical resources that aligns directly with the ideals of knowledge and goodness.
Shifting from institutional assets to student achievements, the extracurricular life is just highly sophisticated. The Philippian, the school's weekly newspaper, has been publishing since 1857,
making it the nation's first secondary school newspaper.
And the independence of the student body is fiercely protected. The paper's mission states that it is entirely uncensored and student-run,
which fosters a level of journalistic maturity and accountability that you just rarely see at the high school level.
But the true highlight of student intellectual rigor in recent years has to be the Phillips Academy poll. This is the first public opinion poll conducted by high school students that has achieved national recognition.
The poll gained national media attention, including features in The New Yorker, for its accuracy in predicting the 2022 midterm election results.
It's evidence that these students aren't just reading textbooks. They are engaging in sophisticated, rigorous, and relevant social science research that influences real-world political commentary.
Athletically, the philosophy is summed up by their motto, Athletics for All.
And just like their academic history, their athletic history is foundational. Andover participated in the first ever high school football game in American history back in 1875 against Adams Academy.
Today, it's a massive athletic powerhouse within the New England Preparatory School system. The school offers 29 interscholastic programs.
And an incredible 44 intramural or instructional programs. That variety is remarkable. It offers everything from fencing and Tai Chi to figure skating and ultimate frisbee. The commitment is clearly to universal participation, not just varsity excellence.
Though they achieve excellence as well.
Oh, for sure. The boys' crew team, for instance, has competed internationally at England's prestigious Henley Royal Regatta, showing that their commitment extends to the highest levels of global amateur competition.
Now, in the spirit of comprehensive knowledge, we have to shift our focus to the necessary counterbalance, the controversies. These issues reflect the ongoing struggle of a traditional institution trying to meet the evolving modern standards of equity and accountability.
And they test that ideal of non-civi fundamentally. The source material outlines three key areas where Phillips Academy has faced intense scrutiny. The first was in 2013 when the school drew national attention for apparent gender bias.
This was highlighted specifically by a noticeable lack of female representation in major student leadership positions at the time.
And it sparked internal and external debate about whether the merger with Abbott Academy in 1973 had really created equal opportunity.
Following that, in 2016 and 2017, the most serious historical allegation surfaced. Reports identified former teachers who had been involved in inappropriate sexual contact with students over a period of time in the school's past.
The school's response was immediate and comprehensive. They hired an independent law firm to investigate the allegations of historical misconduct, and school officials stressed that transparency and a commitment to ensuring these transgressions would never happen again were paramount to rebuilding trust.
And the most recent and profound reckoning happened around issues of racial equity in 2020.
Right. This was driven by the rise of the anonymous Instagram account at Black at Andover, which started circulating dozens of detailed stories from students identifying as Black. These narratives detailed painful personal experiences with racism on campus.
But this went far beyond just documenting individual racist incidents, didn't it?
It did. The core of the critique focused heavily on systemic issues within the school's disciplinary apparatus. Students reported perceived racial disparities in disciplinary outcomes, arguing that the system emphasized punitive measures over restorative justice.
And there were also concerns raised about a lack of due process outlined in the student handbook's procedures.
The public nature and severity of this critique, which was covered in national outlets like the New York Times, prompted a significant institutional response. The administration formed an anti-racism task force, which spent 2 years investigating and released its final report in March 2022.
These controversies are vital parts of the institution's current story. They really force a critical assessment of whether the wealth and resources, the $1.41 billion endowment, the world-class facilities, are truly serving the ideal of non-CB and the youth from every quarter motto.
Or whether institutional traditions and biases continue to undermine that mission. These are the necessary struggles of a 247-year-old institution striving for modern relevance.
So to conclude our deep dive, we have to look at the colossal cultural footprint Phillips Academy has left on the world stage, beginning with its list of notable alumni, which reads like a global power index.
It is truly a list of distinction across every field imaginable. Again, we emphasize the 2 U.S. presidents, the 5 Nobel laureates, and the 6 Medal of Honor recipients across 4 different American conflicts.
But the list is so diverse. You have leaders in law enforcement like FBI Director Christopher Wray, figures in finance and philanthropy like Ed Bass, and Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes. The sheer volume of influential people is staggering.
And this influence extends into culture and sports. You see actors like Humphrey Bogart, Jack Lemmon, and Olivia Wilde. You find the creator of Tarzan, writer Edgar Rice Burroughs. And in sports, the legendary NFL coach Bill Belichick. The variety proves the school is not just a political feeder, but a multifaceted cultivator of talent.
It also has international reach, educating figures in foreign affairs and royalty, like King Jigme Khesar Namgyel Wangchuck of Bhutan.
And going back to its original purpose of fostering goodness, it educated one of the most prominent 19th century abolitionists, Theodore Dwight Weld.
Phillips Academy's identity is just so distinct and recognizable that it's become cultural shorthand for the elite in popular media.
Which brings us to its footprint in literature and film.
In literature, you see the duality of the school's reputation captured perfectly. F. Scott Fitzgerald, in This Side of Paradise, portrays Andover through this aspirational lens, calling it a college-like democracy.
But you contrast that with J.D. Salinger's decidedly more cynical perspective in The Catcher in the Rye, where a boy from Andover is used specifically to embody an air of pretentious boy, a symbol of entrenched social status and condescension.
And that tension between the school's stated democratic ideals and the perceived pretension that comes with its social status, it's permanent. Tom Wolfe leveraged this reputation, using Andover as the ultimate shorthand for the elite prep look in his 1977 book.
And in film, it serves as an immediate marker of high-level pedigree. In Scent of a Woman, when Al Pacino's character makes a mistake about the former president's background,
Chris O'Donnell's character instantly corrects him, emphasizing that George H.W. Bush attended Andover. That correction is essential to establishing the character's lineage and social standing.
And of course, for pop culture fans, the lore extends into the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where it's established that Tony Stark attended Phillips Academy from 1977 to 1984 before moving on to MIT.
It places the institution firmly in the public imagination as the place where future geniuses and power players are forged.
So, what does this all mean for you, the listener? Our deep dive has taken us on a remarkable journey, tracing Phillips Academy from its earliest days as a small, fiercely orthodox Calvinist ministry school founded during the height of the Revolution.
To the massive, globally influential and secular $1.41 billion endowed powerhouse it is today.
It represents a really successful institutional evolution. It transformed itself into a non-sectarian school that tries to balance its extreme wealth and exclusivity with a profound commitment to access.
Evidenced by its need-blind policy and its promise to meet 100% of demonstrated financial need for nearly half of its students.
Phillips Academy, in microcosm, exemplifies both the incredible resilience and continuity of American educational tradition. It's still the oldest incorporated academy, and the ongoing complex struggle for true equity within elite institutions.
The generosity of the need-blind policy sits in sharp contrast with the demographic reality of pervasive wealth and the difficult public reckoning over historical misconduct and racial equity.
The institution has successfully shed the original theological mandate that required all teachers and trustees to be Protestant. That demonstrates a clear embrace of radical, necessary change. And yet, it chooses to retain that powerful foundational Latin motto, Finis origin pendet.
The end depends upon the beginning.
Which raises a powerful question for you to consider as you process this history. If the end that Phillips Academy seeks today is defined by radical global access, socioeconomic integration, and social equity, how much do those revolutionary era beginnings, founded by Calvinist businessmen manufacturing gunpowder, tied to powerful political elites, and initially constrained by the cultural biases of the time, how much do those beginnings still shape the institution?
How does a school so reliant on tradition and the perpetuation of family lineage manage to fully embrace a future defined by radical change, ensuring the non-SIBI truly means not for self, for everyone?
A perfect thought to end on as we contemplate the weight of history versus the speed of change.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive into Phillips Academy. We will see you next time.
DC politicians want to enact harmful credit card mandates that could take away your cash back and rewards points, perks that stretch your budget and make life a little easier. Losing these benefits means less money for your family's everyday essentials like gas and groceries. The perks you rely on could disappear, leaving you with higher costs and fewer options. Tell Congress to guard your card and oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card mandates.
Paid for by Electronic Payments Coalition.